Hello, folks. I apologize for being late and showing up here. My schedule this week has been tangled up by the fact I'm in Geneva rather than in Boston during a lot of meetings with that are related to this course. So one effect of that change in my schedule is that I'm going to have to end the office hours here after 1 hour rather than an hour and a half, enable me to get to give a lecture at the University of Geneva. So apologies in advance. So let me begin with a few notes about logistics and see if you have any question. You may have noticed that at the bottom of the syllabus page for the course is a lot of new material in which we collectively have tried to address your concerns, both about the exam and about the mechanics of gaining access to some of the materials. So there's a lot of much additional discussion of the timing of the exam. Perhaps the most important detail to emphasize is that whereas previously we planned to have a 4-day window in which you could take the exam, that's been expanded to 5 days to accommodate the students will be otherwise committed by the conclusion of Ramadan. So there's a little bit larger window in which you can take it. And there's some additional information about the manner evaluated and the dates on which grades will be released. I also have included at the bottom of the syllabus page links to a variety of other materials. And we'll be gradually filling in those links as we go along. So there is a link now to an updated the current version of the map that you sometimes see in the background of the lecture. And to all the slides, to all of the office hours that have been conducted thus far, there will soon be a link to this one. And I will be slowly filling in the transcripts, which are
that's being.
So that's a bit of information about the modification of the homepage. So judging, you asked, could I share the link? The link is just the ordinary link for the syllabus for the course. If is it not, if you don't see on it the new material I just discussed, you should refresh your browser, meaning reload the page, and you should see at the bottom a lot of new material. Questions, reactions to any of the new logistical stuff? Peter.
Yes, Professor. I just wanted to clarify, because I know that information about the final exam is there already. If it's sort of, we have the whole 5 days to work on it, or is it like once I open it, then I've only got a few hours to work on it? Or is it like I download a file and I have the whole 5 days to submit?
Yeah, you're right. I should be more explicit about this. You have the entire 5 days. No, it certainly does not take 5 days to answer the exam well. If you are spending more than 8 hours on it, something is wrong. Most students find they can write a very good exam in 4 to 5 hours. But if you want, you can take as long, you could, if you wanted, take the entire 5 days. There is no machinery that would cut off your access after a limited period of time. I should probably make that more explicit. Okay. Any other questions about the mechanics? All right. Then let's move on to substance. Any questions about the material we've covered thus far or that are coming up in the this coming week? Mateo.
Professor, good morning. For you, for everyone, thank you for the opportunity. So I want, if you can explain broadly why exhaustion in Lemar case constricts the ability of patentees to engage in differential pricing. Thanks.
Sure. So there are, as you know from the recorded lecture, two dimensions of exhaustion. There's domestic and there's international. It's easier to answer your question with the exhaustion aspect, so I'll stress that. So international exhaustion is an option. Some jurisdictions have chosen it, and some jurisdictions have not. And the TRIPS agreement leaves them free to choose what regime they want. The jurisdictions that currently have international exhaustion include the United States, which recently shifted to this position. So what's the relationship between international exhaustion and differential pricing? Well, what international exhaustion does is it prevents the patentee from blocking the reimportation into the United States or whatever jurisdiction we're talking about of products that have been sold either by the patentee or by an authorized licensee anywhere in the world. So what that means as a practical matter is that if I suppose I'm a patentee and I'm selling a patented product at a high price in the United States, figuring that I can earn a generous profit, and at a lower price in a poorer country, say Malawi, in order to maximize my profits in a jurisdiction where people have less disposable income, I cannot prevent you, Mateo, from going to Malawi, buying a large stash of my products, shipping them back into the United States and underselling me. So the result of international exhaustion is to facilitate arbitrage across international boundaries and thereby to make it harder for patentees to price differently at different countries. Okay. That's the way it works. Now, I want to emphasize that exhaustion doesn't prevent differential pricing altogether. It just makes it more difficult and expensive. So by way of illustration, within the European Union, there's regional exhaustion, meaning that if you sell a product within the European Union, you can't prevent a buyer from purchasing it in the country where it's sold and transporting it to another country in the EU and selling and reselling it there. And that discourages differential pricing within the EU. That's its purpose. But doesn't prevent it altogether. And you can find in the EU some significant differences in prices at which goods are sold. So, and in particular in the pharmaceutical area, the way this is done most often is that the manufacturer of the drug sells it in different dosages with different labels in different countries. And that makes it inconvenient for arbitrageurs to say, buy the drugs at low prices in Greece, which is an example where the price is usually lower, and sell them at higher prices in Denmark. It's possible, but harder.
Okay, so because I had in my mind that one of the, let's say, rights that the patent give to the patentee is to prevent another person from import your own creation, right?
Right.
So it's also contrast with the exhaustion theory that if I sell my product, I lost all that rights. So I was thinking about how can I prevent from getting those products and let's say have another person selling them and then become my competitor selling my own products. How can that be possible, remaining that having in mind that, bear in mind that there is antitrust law also in most of the countries that have TRIPS agreement in their own law. So I don't know, for me that was like the big doubt in my mind. How can I as a patentee can prevent another person become my competitor selling my own products?
So you're right that exhaustion is a exception, a qualification to the patentee's right to prevent importation of products embodying the patented technology. So the affirmative right is the right to block products coming into the country, and exhaustion qualifies that. It doesn't eliminate it altogether. It just creates an exception that arises in circumstances in which the product being imported was first sold with the authority of the patentee. So if the product in question is first manufactured and sold by a competitor, then exhaustion does not operate. It only operates to prevent exclusion of products sold with authorization. So as a practical matter, it doesn't impair the ability of the patentee to curb competition. What it impairs is the ability of the patentee to, as is sometimes said, get two bites of the apple, meaning to extract a larger revenue from one market than from another market.
I got it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Anna.
Thank you, Professor. Yes. I was reflecting on the TRIPS agreement, Article 31, Annex, excuse me, Article 31 bis and this annex, and its annex. This article and its annex specifies that some countries members will not use the system as importing members. And that some other members have stated that if they use a system, it would be no more than situations of national emergency, etc. The members that have opted out for not using this Article 31B as importing members includes some countries of the European Union and United States of America. My question is, please, does it mean that these countries are binded by Article 31B? Does it mean that they have not ratified this article? What does it mean? Is this article in force with regards these countries? Because some professors here in Stockholm have told me that Article 31B of the TRIPS is not in force. It's not in force for European Union countries. But the annex of the website of the World Trade Organization says that that does not say exactly that. It only says that these countries have used the clause or the possibility to opt out. What does it mean, please? Could you explain that? What is the meaning of this clause? Thank you.
So Anna, that's an excellent question, but I think I'm not going to answer it right now. And the reason is that in 2 weeks, The section where we're dealing with modifications of the intellectual property system, we're going to address that issue directly. And indeed, by chance, I just had an email exchange with Jayashree Watal, who plans to lead our discussion on just that issue. So rather than do it provisionally here, I'm just going to postpone it for a little while and promise we'll get to it.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. Pablo.
Good morning, Professor. Good morning for everyone. Thank you for your time. Professor, how we understand the influence between the fairness theory, the welfare theory, and the cultural theory in front of the different pricing status of patents? And second, what is the real implication of the cross licenses between the royalty stocking that you mentioned in the last lecture of this week?
Yeah, okay. So those are two very good, hard questions. So with respect to the first, here's I'm going to give you a brief summary, and then I'm going to point to sort of some other materials if you want to pursue it further. So here's the brief summary. There are currently in the world four main theories of intellectual property. And by theories, I mean philosophic justifications for an intellectual property system of any sort. The names vary slightly, but typical labels for the four theories are first, welfare, second, fairness, third is personality, and fourth is cultural. So I'm going to give you an illustration of how these things apply in the copyright area, where you can see all four of them. So in the copyright area, the welfare theory centers on the potential benefit of copyright law in stimulating innovation that otherwise would not occur, and ensuring that the fruits thereof are made available to the public at large, thereby benefiting the greatest good of the greatest number, a utilitarian goal. That's number one. Number two is the fairness theory, which in the copyright context emphasizes the natural right of the creator of an intellectual product to claim ownership of the fruits of his or her labor. This is a outgrowth of the labor theory of property in general. It's especially powerful in common law jurisdictions. That's number two. Number three is the personality theory, which emphasizes in the copyright context the importance of the law respecting the bond between an artist and his or her creation. And its principal manifestation in the law is the doctrine of moral rights, which is very powerful in civil law jurisdictions, less powerful in common law jurisdictions. And finally, the cultural theory emphasizes the potential of the copyright system to foster social conditions that facilitate human flourishing. And they include political democracy, semiotic democracy, self-realization through creativity, and so forth. So as I say, I used copyright to illustrate the four approaches because it's in the copyright field that you can see all four in action. In patent law, the relevance of the four theories is more uneven. As a practical matter, in patent law, the personality theory, which gives rise to moral rights doctrine in Europe and Latin America, has much less role because, generally speaking, philosophers and lawyers do not regard inventors as having tight psychic bonds with their creations, the way a graphic artist can feel a connection to his or her painting. So the personality theory of intellectual property doesn't have much bite in the patent field. The labor or fairness theory has a bit more power that you can find in patent law, sometimes an effort to reshape the law so as to ensure that inventors are fairly rewarded. An example of that came up very early in this course when we were discussing the rules in different jurisdictions pertaining to employment and how fairly employees are treated, arguably more fairly in many jurisdictions than in the United States. The theory of the four theories, the one that has by far the greatest influence in patent law is the welfare theory, the utilitarian argument that the justification for patent law is to stimulate socially beneficial innovation that otherwise would not occur, and thereby benefit the public at large. You've seen many examples of that general rhetoric in this course, and in academic writing, it looms largest. So economists tend to write about patent law from that perspective, and they have especially strong influence. Cultural theory enters patent law much less often, but as we'll see, happens to be especially relevant to public health, because one of the aspects of human flourishing is access to medical technologies and care that can provide each person the capacity to live a full life. That's a cultural theory argument, also partakes in the general argument of human rights. So those are the four approaches in general. And as you can see, they're unevenly applied in the context of patent law. The reason why they are relevant to differential pricing is that it is possible to justify geographic differential pricing on a variety of theoretical grounds. So from a welfare theory standpoint, differential pricing can be justified as a way of augmenting the profits of the inventor and thereby stimulating more inventive activity without limiting distribution, because differential pricing enables poorer people to gain access to the product at lower prices. So that's a welfare theory justification of differential pricing. A cultural theory observes that distribution of access to medical care currently in the world is radically unequal and is outrageous from the standpoint of the cultural theory. And differential pricing offers one among many strategies for alleviating that inequality. And now that argument I'm just stating in sort of bald form for right now, but we will spend not this coming week, but the week after quite a bit of time examining how it might work in practice. So that was meant to be a summary. I realize it's a little bit long-winded, but that's an explanation of how the four theories operate and how they apply to differential pricing. Now, your second question concerned royalty stacking. Now, this is a totally different issue. It arises in the context of injunctive relief. So one of the arguments that some, not all, economists have made against granting injunctions in patent cases is that in fields of technology where there are multiple patentees who can lay a claim on each product, each of those patentees will demand a license fee that in the aggregate will make it difficult, if not impossible, to manufacture the product in question. The premier example is a cell phone. Each cellular telephone, smartphone, typically contains technology that reads on thousands of patents. And if each patentee were able to demand a freely negotiated fee and threaten an injunction if it's not paid, the result would be to enable them to stack up royalties to a prohibitively high level. That's the argument. Now, as I tried to suggest in the recorded lecture, not all economists agree with this. In fact, it's fair to say that the more sophisticated group of economists found that the prediction of royalty stacking is not borne out in practice. So it's a contested claim rather than a conclusive claim.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. Qualitas.
Afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, Prof. Right. My question is in relation to patent duration and infringement. I understand that the provisional remedy starts from the date of publication. Now, my question is that, does that mean the applicant cannot prevent infringement act between the filing date and until between the filing date and the publication period, as it appears that the provisional remedy starts from the date of publication? So it's just a simple question that I wanted you to I wanted to get clarity from you. Thanks, Prof.
The answer is yes. The patentee cannot, either before or after the patent is issued, obtain relief for the period of time between the filing and publication. That's true, only for the period after publication, and can only recover those remedies after the grant. And the justification for that rule is that until the date of publication, the defendant has no reason to know that he or she is abridging a patent. Now, as your question probably implies, it's not a totally convincing explanation. After all, the applicant can voluntarily provide a copy of the application to the defendant and demand that the defendant cease and desist. So it's not an overwhelming justification, but the rule is exactly as you stated it.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Prof. I hear you. But now, the principle of filing date, it means that I thought the reason why the term of protection is calculated from the filing date would mean that the protection starts from the filing date until the term is expired. During the publication period, it's a time where now the patent is made available to the public. Therefore, there should be a measure to safeguard such. But from the date of filing to that period, I think my assumption or my thinking was that the applicant would have provisional rights, so to speak.
Yeah, that's a very interesting perspective. The different jurisdictions arrived at the 20-year term from different starting points, but let's take the U.S. for a moment. Until recently, the term of a patent in the United States was 17 years from the date of grant, not 20 years from the date of filing. And the one of the arguments offered effectively in favor of abandonment of the original U.S. rule in favor of the 20 years from date of filing is that they're roughly comparable. That as a practical matter, 20 years from the date of filing does not give you 20 years of protection and is not intended to give you 20 years of protection. It's intended to give you approximately 17 years of protection. So why do we measure it from the date of filing? Well, because by using the date of filing as the starting point, we put pressure on the applicant to move expeditiously to prosecute the application and to get a grant because the clock is running. And that in turn discourages so-called submarine patents. So it used to be distressingly common for a scheming patent applicant to file the patent application and then slowly prosecute it, waiting until another firm had adopted a potentially infringing technology, and then to bring, in the metaphor, the submarine to the surface and bring an infringement suit. That behavior is more or less prevented by using the filing date as the start. So the purpose of, to summarize, the purpose of using the term is 20 years from the date of filing is not to make an effective patent from the date of filing. It's rather to set an outer time limit to the duration. And the expectation is that the effective life is going to be around 17 years.
Thanks, Prof.
Welcome. Minhee.
Oh, yeah. Hello, good evening, everyone. I have a question about the royalty issue and how can handle royalty issues when it is related with currency conversion problems, especially if there are large fluctuation in the exchange rate. How is it reflected? Thank you.
So there are two different contexts in which this arises. There are voluntary license agreements and the royalty terms that are associated with them. And then there are so-called reasonable royalties as a remedy for patent infringement. And your question has a different bearing in those two contexts. With respect to the first one, the way in which most, not all, patent licenses are set up is that the licensee agrees to pay a certain percentage of revenues. And the result is that in whatever currency the licensee earns money from selling the product at issue, the licensee has to take the prescribed percentage of that and turn it over to the patentee. If the patentee happens to be in a different jurisdiction, that will indeed involve currency exchanges, and because currency rates fluctuate, that will either advantage or disadvantage the patentee, but both parties are taking the risk under those circumstances. Okay, that's one context. The other context is the use of reasonable royalties as one of the measures of patent damages for infringement. Now that's different because this doesn't arise out of voluntary agreements between the parties, rather it's imposed by a court. Those impositions, however, are jurisdiction specific because of the national character of the patent system as a whole. You will only be collecting damages for activities by the infringer within a particular jurisdiction, which will be using a single currency. So the issue of the currency exchange issue will not arise there.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Armel.
Yes. Good afternoon, sir. Good afternoon, everyone. Please, I want to have more details regarding the complementary period of protection that can be allowed when somebody has patent right, because you just mentioned that we know that generally we said we have the right for 20 years. But in reality, it is something like 17 years. So I want to know if this complementary period is just attached to pharmaceutical product, because I never heard that in other sectors. How is it organized, please?
This is related to, as you point out, the question that Qualitas asked earlier. So ostensibly, the term of a patent is 20 years from the date of filing. But as you know by now, strictly speaking, that's not true. 20 years from the date of the filing is the date on which the patent expires. It's not a definition of how long the patent is effective. So as a practical matter, there is a portion of time that's subtracted from the beginning. And in some cases, there's a portion of time that's added to the end. So with respect to the beginning, as Qualitas's question pointed out, there's no protection for the period between the date of filing and the date of publication. And there's only provisional protection for the period between the date of publication and the date of grant. So how much time does that mean that the patentee in some sense loses? Well, publication in most jurisdictions now is 18 months after the date of filing. So you lose a year and a half at the beginning, ordinarily. So that can be a little bit longer if there are circumstances that result in the process of patent prosecution stringing out farther. And so it can, the amount of time subtracted from the outset of the term can be longer, but it's a minimum of a year and a half. Now, what about at the other end? As I think I suggested in one of the recorded lectures, in most countries, there are provisions allowing the patentee to get some extra time if there were delays in patent prosecution that were caused by the patent office, not by the patentee, but by the patent office. And this happens fairly frequently to get a year or two tacked on to the end of a patent. Now, and to answer your specific question, in the field of pharmaceutical patents, many jurisdictions, including the United States, have special provisions giving additional extensions to the term of the patent specifically for pharmaceutical patents. And the reason for treating them differently is that it takes longer to develop and then test and to secure approval of a patented pharmaceutical product than anything else. So the result of these extensions is in most jurisdictions to bring the commercial life of a pharmaceutical patent up to approximately 12 years. It would be more like 7 years, but for these extensions. So to summarize, some time is taken off at the beginning, and some time is commonly, though not always, added to the end. And that means that in practical terms, the duration of an ordinary patent is more or less 17 to 18 years. And the duration of a pharmaceutical patent, the commercial life of a pharmaceutical patent, is approximately 12 years.
Okay. I have a second question regarding our previous lessons. We were talking about the excuse offered for a cessation of work while working on a patent, okay? So I wanted to know if, in my case, I have a client who was sick during something like 2 years and he was not able to finalize the patent application. What can happen? Is it a standard period where the person has to finalize the said process? Or it is something that is open according to the fact that you can justify?
There are two possibilities here. Until recently, there were a few jurisdictions in the world, including the United States, that used a first-to-invent system of priority rather than a first-to-file system. And in those jurisdictions, delays of the sort that you describe in pursuing refinement of the technology or filing of the patent would sometimes be excused. And that would be evaluated, if necessary, by a court on a case-by-case basis. So to take your example, if I'm the inventor and I claim to, if I'm the your client and I claim to be the first inventor, but there's a competitor who says, no, I invented it first. I can try to rebut the priority of the competitor by saying, well, but I worked on it as hard as I could, and the reason I didn't go faster is that I was sick for 2 years. Excuses of that sort will be evaluated on a case-by-case basis, ultimately by a court. Okay, that occurred in only a few jurisdictions because the overwhelming majority of jurisdictions in the world applied a first-to-file rather than a first-to-invent approach. The second possibility is that the 2-year delay would be asserted by the applicant, not as a justification for not pursuing the technology, but as a justification for missing the deadline of responding to an office action by the examiner. That's different. Generally speaking, in my experience, the patent offices are pretty strict about that. They don't usually accept excuses, even ones that, as you described them, are quite reasonable. This will be done on a jurisdiction by jurisdiction basis, and I'm not sure which jurisdiction you're referring to, but generally speaking, patent offices are not forgiving with respect to missing deadlines.
Okay, thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome. Byron.
Thank you, Professor. Good morning, everyone. You said that the patentee could have almost 17 years for the exploitation of the patent, assuming that you have filed that patent in the US. But viewing this as a developing country, this is very different because you could have a patent that is in the application stage during 12 or even 15 years. I have a patent that is remaining at the patent office 15 years. And some pharmaceuticals are not motivated to going forward with the process because they are happy with that prosecution here in my country, because they can use that patent process period as a way to threaten another companies to not work with their patents, and that is damaging also our industry because of the lack of knowledge, or maybe the lack of patent examiners that we have in our country. And yes, I would like to have your opinions in this field.
Unfortunately, everything you say is true. There are indeed long delays in many jurisdictions. With respect to pharmaceutical products, the delays can be both with respect to patent prosecution and with respect to marketing authorization. Delays in patent prosecution hamper the eventual patentee, but delays in marketing authorization also hamper the public at large because the drug isn't available for consumption by consumers. So delay in both sectors is problematic. That's true. So why are there such long delays? Well, in most settings, it's because the offices are not well enough funded to hire enough people to keep up with the backlogs. It's usually that simple. Occasionally, there would be more subtle factors at play in which there's deliberate slowdown of applications. But that's usually not the case. Usually, it's just they don't have enough people.
Yes. I have another question regarding criminal procedures. I don't see anything about criminal procedures in other jurisdictions. For example, in my country, you have a criminal action for someone who is using a patent that is granted by others, and that is very, very, very hard to face. I don't know or I would like to have your opinion regarding criminal procedures for patent infringement, and how it could be good or it could damage the system, thinking in the way as a developing country that you could have also these problems in the system, no?
Okay, that's a very good question. So you asked my opinion on this front. My opinion is that in a few contexts, criminal penalties for intellectual property violations make some sense. And the premier example of that is intentional falsified use of trademarks. So if I am selling Nike branded shoes without authority in a particular jurisdiction intentionally, I may be relatively immune to civil suits because I just don't have enough money to make it worthwhile to pursue me, but a criminal sanction will discourage me from engaging in clearly unlawful behavior. So in some contexts, criminal sanctions make sense, but not in the patent context for two reasons. First, all patents, as you know by now, are probabilistic, meaning that they are not necessarily valid. And so it's often a legitimate activity for a firm that in good faith believes the patent is vulnerable to challenge to trigger assessment of its validity by engaging in activity that would be considered infringing. And a criminal penalty will prevent that from occurring. That's one reason. The other reason is that, as I tried to suggest in the recorded lecture for this week, injunctive relief is not always appropriate, meaning that even if a patentee prevails in litigation, it's not always the right solution to force the defendant to shut down. In some circumstances, imposing upon the defendant an ongoing royalty is more socially beneficial, and many jurisdictions in the world now do that. So, but the use of ongoing royalties in place of injunctions would be eliminated if there were a criminal threat hanging over the head of the infringer as well. So my own view is, you're correct in observing that some jurisdictions do have criminal penalties for patent infringement. And in my view, it's a bad idea.
Yes, thank you, Professor. And my last question is regarding test data. Test data, the period that you have after for the 5-year period that you have after getting this information from the validity of a pharmaceutical product, that you could be protected by this 5-year period as a confidential information. There are some remedies that you apply in the US for test data and how it applies.
Yes, so we will go into that a little bit more in the future, but the short answer is that the way the data exclusivity is enforced is that it prevents the competitor from using the data in securing marketing authorization. And the enforcement of that is actually pretty simple. You don't actually have to prevent the competitor from gaining access to the data. It's usually publicly available. What you do is deny them the ability to rely in an application for marketing approval on the data. And that is within the power of the agency in the country to do or not to. So you don't actually have to make the data confidential. You just don't consider it in a marketing approval application by the generic.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. So I think I'm going to be able to take three more questions, and then I'm going to have to go run to give a lecture. Apologies for those who may still be in the queue at the time. So Pratipa, I think you're next on the list.
Good morning, Professor. I have a question regarding to the compulsory license in high income countries. I hope you can hear me. Yeah. Okay. So like in 2020, we have seen that remdesivir itself, the production cost is less than $1, while it is providing to developed countries' government at nearly $300, but for private, it is giving at $500. And in 2020, Russian government has given compulsory license to the Gilead product remdesivir. Interestingly, that year, Gilead has given voluntary licenses to many pharmaceuticals in India to provide a global supply of remdesivir all over the world. Because this drug is very important, keeping in view, it is important for hepatitis and HIV, plus Ebola, as well as COVID. So it is very important drug, and it is justified that the demand was at peak, keeping in view the pandemic was there. So this compulsory license was given by Russian government. We have seen a similar situation when the anthrax attack happened back in 2000 in US, and US government threatened Bayer to lower the prices of ciprofloxacin, otherwise they will give a compulsory license. These incidents, because there is a bio attack, at the same time there is a pandemic, looks justified on part of government to use a compulsory license. But do you think there is a possibility that compulsory license may be misused as a legal tool for market intervention, where price will be regulated according to demand of government, as well as the production and who will do the production? Or it may be misused as a negotiating strategy against pharma lobby in high income countries. What is your opinion in this regard because of increasing incidence of occurrence of such scenarios? What do you think in this regard?
That's a good and difficult question. Here's a brief answer, and you're going to get more detail in the next couple of weeks. The brief answer is, with respect to remdesivir, as you point out, Gilead, which holds a patent on it, entered into a voluntary licensing agreement authorizing generic manufacturers in India and elsewhere to produce it and to sell them in, I think it's about 140 countries. It's a very large set of countries where you can sell them, sell the low-cost version of remdesivir, which was an effort on Gilead's part to address a rather desperate health need. Now, by chance, in 2 weeks, you will be watching a recorded lecture by Clifford Samuel, who is the person who developed that program by Gilead, and he'll explain why he did it and its effects. Now, as you point out, the voluntary licensing approach, which Gilead has pioneered, but it's not the only company. Novartis sometimes uses this and so forth. The voluntary licensing approach is usually limited to low-income or sometimes low- and middle-income countries, which then leaves patients in high-income countries potentially more vulnerable. At a minimum, they'll have to pay higher prices. Occasionally, as you point out, the government of a high-income country will use a compulsory license, usually the threat of a compulsory license rather than the actual license, to force the firm in question to bring its price down. Is this illegitimate? It depends on the context. If the company in question is trying to gouge demand in the context of a genuine health emergency, and the government overcomes that impulse by threatening to use a compulsory license? No, I don't think it's illegitimate. It is a response to an emergency. If it's employed just as a device to obtain political favors from a particular constituency, well, then it's much more debatable. But it's in my view, its legitimacy is context specific.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. Vishmi.
Thank you, Professor. My question is, the fact that when you mentioned that from the date of application until the grant, if there is no protection until the grant of the patent happens, what if an applicant assigns the patent to another party and thereafter there is some form of violation from a third party? But since the patent has not yet been granted, what kind of remedies would someone that an assignee would have in that situation?
The assignee does not have a remedy until the patent is granted. Now, if after the publication, but before the patent grant, if the competitor makes use of the technology without permission, the competitor does so at a risk. If does so knowingly, the competitor may, after the grant, be vulnerable to provisional remedies, damages for its conduct during that period. But until that happens, the assignee has no effective remedy.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. Alejandro, you're the last person whose questions I can take.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor. It's not a question. I'm just to add my personal opinion. I don't know if you agree about it, is that the impossibility to use in every jurisdiction or territory the penal code to prosecute, to make the enforcement of infringement of a patent, because I think that's my personal approach, that it's not possible to create a penal or criminal hypothesis of an infringement in a criminal prosecution using a blank disposition. Every criminal law should be literal in the text of the law. Then, if we permit the use of a claim as a part of a criminal prosecution, we are making a risk to the due process. The due process could be tarnished by this kind of procedure, because obviously we can use the equivalent theory, and then the possibilities of infringement could be several or a thousand possibilities. Then it's impossible to get a conviction in a criminal procedure in base of the theory of equivalence, using some kind of, as Carapapa said, equivalence or maybe variants of a patent in the embodiment. I think, well, I don't know what's your opinion about it. I agree with your two previous explanations about it.
Alejandro, that's very interesting. And as you might imagine, I definitely agree with the thrust of your comment. What you have done is supplement the two considerations that I mentioned in response to Byron with an argument rooted in the theory of the rule of law, which, as you point out, has as one of its tenets the proposition that the force of the state should not be brought to bear on citizens unless the norm that justifies the application of state power is clearly announced in advance. And in the absence of a clear announcement in advance, it's impossible for a citizen to anticipate the exercise of state power. And then you have an autocracy instead of a rule of law. That's the general theory that I think you are drawing upon and drawing upon powerfully. Now, a counter argument could be made, however, that we do accept the legitimacy of criminal prosecutions in cases of unauthorized taking of property, trespass, and theft. And you could analogize criminal patent prosecution to prosecute criminal trespass. They are analogous in the sense that in trespass, as in patent law, the identification of the thing that one is being punished for invading requires filling in the blank, to use your terminology. You fill in the blank with the contours of the boundaries of the plot of land that you are invading. So that one could say, viewed from this broad lens of the theory of the rule of law, that a criminal prosecution of patent violations is as legitimate as criminal sanctions for trespass. So I mentioned this as a counter argument. I think it's only partial because of the difference in the clarity of the boundaries at issue. It's much easier to identify the edges of a real property right than, given the nuances of claim interpretation and the difficulties injected by the doctrine of equivalence, than it is to identify the boundaries of a patent right. So bottom line is, that's a very interesting perspective, and I'm largely in agreement.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you.
You're welcome. So thanks very much to everyone. As I mentioned, I have to go teach a class now, and so I have to have a shorter period than usual, but I will record this session and add it to the set of links at the bottom of the page. Bye for now.
Thank you, Professor.
Bye. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor.
See you next week.
Thank you, Professor. Bye-bye.